thought I would use this opportunity to talk about some different ways in which computational and mathematical modeling can be integrative, since it's an important goal of physiology to obtain an integrative understanding of biological function. And the way I think about this is as three overlapping but somewhat different ways in which computation and theory can be integrative in biology. Probably the best known is what we would think of as data integration, which is really the realm of bioinformatics, integrating data from a wide variety of different sources, such as genomic through to clinical. And at this time, I might give an example of this. The next type of integration I think of is functional integration, which is often referred to these days as in silico systems biology. So this is making reconstructions of the networks that give rise to molecular networks that give rise to biological functions and the interactions between those subsystems to produce cellular and physiological function. So that's kind of functional integration, which tends to be very data limited and data intensive. And then the last type is structural integration across physical scales of biological organization, from molecule to cell to organism. And this is what we often call these days multi-scale computational biology. And this tends to be more computationally limited. And so I'll try and give examples of these different types of approach within the context of the questions related to the electromechanics and excitation-contraction coupling mechanisms in the heart. And so to give like a simple and not very up-to-date example of an analysis that I would think of as functional integration, this is an experiment that a graduate student of mine did over 10 years ago, now in a single rabbit adult ventricular myocyte here. And these black lines you see here and here are the shadows of the ends of two cover slips, one of which is attached to a micromanipulator, the other is attached to a force transducer. And this periodicity you see here is the sarcomeres of the cell. And these are the force tracings at rest and during contraction before and after the cell was stretched by 7.5% from a sarcomere length of 2 to 2.15 micrometers. And the observation that he made was, in fact, one that had been made by von Anrep in 1912 in the intact heart, namely that in addition to an immediate increase in the developed force, which we think of as the Frank-Starling mechanism when the cell is stretched, there was actually a slow component to this rise. And whereas it's been known that that's been associated with an increase in the, or at this time, with an increase in the magnitude of the calcium transient, it hadn't actually been recorded, the forces themselves hadn't been recorded in a single cell. And so he was actually doing this experiment to test the hypothesis that it may be an artifact of multicellular preparations, but it wasn't. And so he'd done a number of experiments to test different hypotheses, that whether it involved calcium handling mechanisms in the cell, whether it involved multicellular interactions. And essentially, by the time time had run out for him to finish his thesis, he had ruled out a lot of mechanisms, but he hadn't identified one. And the candidate that seemed to be most obvious, the remaining that hadn't been investigated, was the cell membrane. And unfortunately, that offers a huge number of possibilities. And so he decided to take advantage of a computational model published by Luo and Rudy of the ventricular myocyte ion currents and excitation-contraction coupling mechanisms, though he had to extend it a little bit to incorporate the interaction between calcium and the myofilaments and the development of force. And then he basically did numerical experiments by perturbing all of the parameters of this model within modest, reasonable ranges to see which, if any of them, perturbations associated with the stretch might give rise to this slow component of the force rise, because the model as it was formulated did have a Frank Starling mechanism, but it did not have an anaerobic effect. And so to cut a long story short, he did find that there were some perturbations, some parameters that would give rise to a slow rise in force with about the same time constant that was seen experimentally. And essentially all those perturbations did the same thing, which is they gave rise to an increase in intracellular sodium. In this case, in this particular example, as a result of decreasing the activity of the sodium-potassium pump. And that increase in intracellular sodium caused a rise in intracellular calcium because of the effect of that increase in sodium concentration on the sodium-calcium exchanger in running in the reverse mode, which caused an increase in intracellular calcium. And at the time, the only experiments to address that hypothesis had actually concluded that there wasn't an increase in intracellular sodium associated with stretch to explain the anaerobic effect. But the following year, in fact, the first of a number of papers was published that showed there was and is in fact a rise in intracellular sodium, and went on to identify the putative mechanism, which involved actually an exchanger that wasn't even in this original model. But nevertheless, it was an example of a functionally integrated systems model, a set of ordinary differential equations that could be used for a numerical experiment to make a prediction that was subsequently verified experimentally. So that's the that was the sort of models that we were doing about 10 years ago. And so I'll skip a lot of intermediate work and talk about a more recent effort in the last few years where we've been interested in the regulation of these processes, particularly via beta adrenergic receptor signaling. And so this cartoon now overlays the major components of the beta 1 adrenergic receptor signaling pathway. I think in the interest of time, I won't go through it all, other than to say that when the receptor is activated by ligands such as norepinephrine or drug like isoproterenol, cyclic AMP accumulates and activates protein kinase A, which phosphorylates a number of targets in the cell that are responsible for the action potential, and particularly the calcium handling mechanisms, and thus has the net effect of increasing the contractility of the cardiac cell by increasing both the magnitude and the rate of uptake of the cytosolic calcium in the cell. So the question is, how do we extend a model, a systems model that describes the kinetics of these ionic currents and intracellular calcium handling with these biochemical processes? And the answer is the first thing we have to do is formulate a mechanistic signaling pathway. I guess before I show you that, just wanted to point out that this is a particularly important pathway, not only in health but in disease. Blockers of the beta adrenergic receptors and one of the most widely prescribed class of medicines in this country for a variety of conditions, especially high blood pressure, coronary heart disease, arrhythmias, and congestive heart failure. And it's particularly of interest that a lot of the pathology associated with this pathway seems to be related to the fact that these neurohormonal pathways adapt in response to impairments in the ability of the heart to function. So this is what I mean by mechanistic signaling diagram. And although this reaction scheme might look complex, in fact, if you were a biochemist studying this pathway, you'd say it was highly oversimplified. Most of those simplifications weren't motivated by a desire for mathematical simplicity. They were motivated by the necessity to reduce the number of parameters that we needed to identify from the published literature. But even so, in order to put this model together, which consists of 40 differential equations and 20 algebraic equations, Jeff Sorcerman, who did this work, needed to identify 78 parameters from 57 papers in the published literature. Okay. What do these equations look like? Well, they really fall into four categories. So the first class of equations, basically these are the binding reactions like a receptor-ligand interaction or complex formation, we use mass action kinetics, so first order rate laws like this, giving rise to differential equations. For enzyme-mediated reactions, we use a quasi-equilibrium assumption and a Michaelis-Menten type of scheme, which therefore results in differential and algebraic equations with fewer constants than we would need if we were to use full mass action kinetics. Then we have to account for compartmentation of some of the processes, signaling processes in the cell. And to do that, we use equations that basically reduce the effective volume or increase the effective concentration of, say, cyclic AMP or some other second messenger in a particular domain. And then finally, because of the quasi-equilibrium assumption, we need to identify pools quasi that are at equilibrium and make sure that mass is conserved in those pools. And so we get additional algebraic equations that are associated with mass conservation. And so the result is that from that mechanistic signaling diagram, we can formulate equations that are both linear ODEs, nonlinear ODEs, and algebraic equations. Then, of course, there's a lot of work to do, right? In particular, you've got to validate, and ideally you want to validate with independent data, individual modules or subcomponents of the system. And essentially, that's what Jeff did in his JBC paper in 2003, eventually working all the way up to validating the effects on the calcium transient in response to agonists. But for example, here's a time course of cyclic AMP accumulation following the administration of adrenergic agonist, and this is the time course in the model, shows pretty good agreement with two independent experiments. Similarly, the dose response to isoproterenol with and without inhibition of phosphodiesterases that tend to break down cyclic AMP is seen here, and so on and so forth. So this model was extensively validated with independent experimental data. Along the way, we found some inconsistencies and even had to go back to authors of the paper to clarify some problems and discover at least one published error. So if we go sort of to the look now at the model as a whole, here, for example, we see what happens when isoproterenol is given. Here's a control calcium transient inside the cell, and with isoproterenol, we get a large increase in the amplitude, but also an increase in the recovery, the rate of reuptake of calcium from the cytosol in fairly good agreement with experiments. This is actually our model, a subsequent version of the model that was implemented for the rabbit heart. And then here we see the effect of agonist stimulation on the action potential, transmembrane potential, and you can see that, as expected, the isoproterenol reduces the action potential duration by about 10%. So we've used this model to investigate a number of different questions, and I'll just show you one in the interest of time today, which is a genetic disease or a family of genetic diseases known as long QT syndrome, in which the interval between the Q wave of the QRS complex and the T wave corresponding to the repolarization is prolonged. So in other words, a longer action potential, ventricular action potential, leads to a longer QT interval. And this, in turn, can predispose the heart to arrhythmias, and this can be life-threatening in a large fraction of people with these genetic diseases die prematurely of sudden cardiac death. We're interested in the most prevalent form, which is LQT1, which is associated with defects in the gene KCNQ1, which codes for the pore-forming subunit of a channel, potassium channel responsible for an ion current known as IKS. LQT1 was of particular interest because studies suggest that life-threatening or, in this case, lethal cardiac events, usually in LQT1 patients, in this case 82% of them, associated with either exercise or emotional stress, which therefore implicates the beta-adrenergic system as being somehow involved, either directly or indirectly, in this pathology. Okay? The specific KCNQ1 mutation that we studied was one that was identified in population in Finland, and this is the mutation, this G589D mutation. And in this nice paper from Rocky Kess's group in Science, they identified the mechanism by which this particular gene mutation affects the function of the potassium channel in the of this potassium channel. And it turned out that the mutation, which occurs here near the C-terminus on the cytoplasmic tail of this ion channel, it's a mutation in a leucine zipper, which is a domain to which another protein binds to the channel, and that protein is called yotiao. So apparently for its similarity to the Chinese breakfast noodle in appearance or otherwise. The thing about yotiao is it's an A kinase anchoring protein, which means that it anchors protein kinase A and phosphatase to the vicinity of the serine 27 that gets phosphorylated by protein kinase A during beta adrenergic stimulation, and thus increases the current through the channel. Okay? And the mutation effectively prevents yotiao from binding to the channel, therefore prevents pKa and phosphatase concentrations from being concentrated at the channel, thus effectively reducing the ability of beta adrenergic stimulation to phosphorylate the channel and alter its function. Okay. So we incorporated that mechanism into the model that coupled the signaling pathway to the excitation-contraction coupling mechanisms, and I don't have time to go through all the results, but at rest, in the unstimulated state, you see G589T and wild type here are not different. Okay? So this has no effect at baseline. This mutation has no effect at baseline when there's without adrenergic stimulation. But if we add isoproterenol, you can see whereas normally the action potential gets shorter in the mutant, it actually gets longer, and therefore the QT interval gets longer, and this would therefore explain the long QT phenotype. And the consequences of that were, particularly at certain periods after excitation or stimulation of the beta adrenergic system, is that these prolonged action potentials could actually get long enough to cause the calcium channel to become reactivated and result in these cellular arrhythmias, so-called early after depolarizations. Okay. Now that's not sudden death, but it was interesting. And so I'll come back to this in a moment, but that's an example of functionally integrated models. And now I want to switch to multi-scale, structurally integrated models. And we've done models here at the subcellular scale, the whole cell, the tissue and whole heart scales. I don't have time to show them all, but I'll concentrate mostly on this stuff. Okay. So in order to make the kind of measurements in living cells that we need to validate these models, we need to be able to observe the kinetics of these signaling pathways in the live cell. And so we take advantage of new tools that are being developed that use fluorescence resonance energy transfer to design biosensors, recombinant biosensors that can be inserted into cells by gene transfection. And the particular experiments that we did here use a reporter called ACAR2, an A kinase activity reporter. And the way that ACAR2 works is that it contains a protein kinase A substrate, and when pKa phosphorylates this recombinant sensor, okay, then that phosphotyrosine residue binds to this FHA domain and pulls these two mutants of green fluorescence protein close enough together such that when the cyan fluorescence protein is excited in at its bandwidth, then that its emission actually excites the yellow fluorescence protein. And so by taking the ratio of YFP emission to CFP emission, we get a measure of the activity of protein kinase A in the living cell. Okay. And so there's all kinds of experiments that we can do with this, and I'll just show you one. One of them is to bypass the receptor and proximal parts of the signaling cascade and immediately release cyclic AMP. And the way we can do that is using a caged molecule, a caged cyclic AMP, that is uncaged and released by a flash of UV light. So here, for example, here's the signal at rest, and then there isn't much fret. Okay? And then when we flash it with, when it's loaded with caged cyclic AMP and flashed with UV light, then the protein kinase A activity goes up all through the cell. But what we could also do then is focus that flash of light on a portion of the cell and then actually create a gradient of excitation and watch the kinetics and the limitations to the spread of that signal through the cell. And so it's with that particular experiment that motivated this study that used the tool developed by Les Lowe's resource at the University of Connecticut called Virtual Cell. And basically what we were able to do was combine the signaling pathway that I described before with a finite volume mesh built from the microscopy image of the cell, and then impose the boundary conditions, specify the diffusion coefficient for cyclic AMP, and see what happens, and adjust the parameters of the model to see what conditions best reproduce the experimental observations. And so there's a lot here, and obviously the data are very noisy, but on average, when we used a diffusion coefficient of about 100 microns squared per minute for cyclic AMP, we were able to reproduce the average properties of these gradients that we induced experimentally. And then we were able to do experiments to basically work out what the barriers to diffusion were of cyclic AMP were, and the effect of buffering by protein kinase A and cyclase and so forth. So that 100 microns squared per second actually was close to, on the order of magnitude, but smaller than some experimental reports. So next I want to talk about the tissue scale, and I'll come back to the story of the long QT syndrome in a minute, but this model is a model of a wedge, a block of the ventricular wall. Okay? So now we've gone from network to cell to tissue. Okay? And this block of the in this case of the rabbit ventricular wall is a popular preparation for studying heterogeneity of electrical activity in the heart wall, because it enables access to the variations that occur across the thickness of the wall that otherwise are difficult to probe experimentally. So we wanted to make a computational version of this ventricular wedge preparation, and the components of it were as follows. In addition to the geometry and the muscle fiber architecture of the tissue wedge, the cellular model of the ion currents and calcium handling mechanisms, we wanted to account for the regional differences that have been described between cells isolated from the outside, the epicardium, the inside, the endocardium, and the mid-wall, or so-called M cells. And so these parameters were determined from the literature. Most of that literature was actually done on experiments in the dog, so there's some estimation here. But in this analysis, we account for regional differences between the three layers of the wall, of the following ion currents, the IKR, IKS, IKP, the sodium current, and the transient outlet current. And when we put all these together in the rabbit ventricular myocyte model, we get differences in action potential duration at typical stimulation rates, as to what you see here, where the cells in the mid-wall have the longest action potential duration and the walls on the epicardium have the shortest action potential duration. So if we put this now together into a continuum model, we need a field theory or a continuum theory to do that. And the theory is a monodomain model of electrical impulse propagation, where this is a reaction diffusion equation. Vm is the transmembrane potential, Cm is the membrane capacitance, Ion is the sum of all the ion currents that those differential equations for the single cell model described. And D, this diffusion coefficient, it represents the anisotropic conductivity for the spread of current in three dimensions in the tissue with respect to the muscle fiber orientation. So this is a reaction diffusion equation where the reactions are the ionic currents responsible for the action potential, and that can support a wave-like propagating, regenerating impulse. And so this is what the model looks like. This is the inner surface of the ventricle and the stimulate, which we stimulate. Okay? And you can see the activation spreads rapidly from inside to outside, and the recovery spreads from outside to inside. And notice that the three different action potentials here look different than the isolated single cell values. And in fact, even though the mid-myocardial cells have the longest action potential, they do repolarize after the epicardial cells, so that the sequence, there's excitation from inside to outside, recovery from outside to inside, with the result that both the T wave representing the recovery and the QRS or the R wave representing the excitation both have the same direction. So this is a result of the electrotonic interactions between the different cell types. This is what happens when we introduce the LQT1 gene mutation and create conditions that will give rise to those EADs. And a number of things happen, some of which have been described clinically. One we see here is that we get an EAD, but the EAD actually is predominantly on the endocardium, and we get a very large T wave. This is probably way too big to be seen in the clinic, although a report did come out about the time that we did this that described so-called Himalayan T waves in LQT1 patients. Another thing we see here is a bifurcated T wave, which has been described before. And we also have here an alternance. If we did more of these, this pattern would sometimes repeat. So a number of clinical manifestations of LQT1 seem to be reproduced in this model. That's by no means to say that we've identified the mechanisms of sudden death in LQT1, but rather that this is an approach that may help to yield insights, especially since there aren't genetically engineered mouse models of LQT1, basically because the IKS current doesn't play a significant role in the repolarization of the mouse action potential.
And just from studies by Antelovich, who introduced this last one with all possible artifacts, you always suggest at least that all the EADs are coming from the longest action potentials of the M cells.
Right.
In this one, you show that that's not the case. Is this particular for this genetic mutation? Can you explain why then?
We were actually able to observe EADs rising all over the place in this model, but the endocardium seemed to be more common. But I would have to say that I couldn't say that this was only for this model. We haven't investigated it enough.
But so it's not dependent on the cell with the longest action potential.
So next I want to talk a little bit about mechanics and applying a multi-scale approach to the mechanics of the ventricular wall. One of the things that we need to model the mechanics of the ventricular wall is the models of the anatomy and fiber and sheet architectures of the wall, as Theo described, and these are reconstructions from Peter Hunter's lab of the fiber architecture and the sheet architecture, and this is the dog, this is the pig model. So we can take advantage of the great deal of amount of work that various groups have put into reconstructing these anatomic models to formulate finite element models of the mechanics of the ventricular wall that basically are solutions for the equations of conservation of mass, momentum, and energy that incorporate the pressure, boundary conditions. Generally, these have to be generated by a hemodynamic model, because as the heart contracts, it develops the pressure load against which it that is contracting. We have to include the myofiber and sheet distributions and the 3D, three-dimensional mechanical properties of the wall, like Julius described before lunch. I thought I'd throw this slide in, since Julius had mentioned his observation that making the constitutive properties of the heart wall three-dimensional during systole, in other words, allowing that the active tension may be partially transmitted, transverse to as well as along the filament of the cells, seemed to be important, and we've made the same observation, in order to get a reasonable agreement with experimental observations. And there is some isolated tissue testing data to support that, but as Theo Apps pointed out, not very much. So we asked ourselves what could be the mechanisms by which active stress would be developed in three dimensions in the contracting heart. And the answer really is a multi-scale question in itself, because one of the answers has to do within the that within the strongly bound state, the cross bridge is not parallel to my filament axis because it has to bridge the space of the lattice between the thick and thin filaments. And as a result, the angle that the cross bridge makes to the thin filament is about 30 degrees in the strongly bound state. Now, if you take a moment about, or if you assume that moments about that attachment point are zero, which is an assumption that was made by Schoenberg in 1980, then you would actually assume that, you would actually conclude that up to half of the active tension would be being transmitted sideways to the lattice. But then how that translates into stress that gets transmitted through to the outside of the cell, if you like, depends on the filament lattice geometry. And then once you've resolved that at this scale, okay, then how that manifests itself at the tissue scale also depends on the fact that the cells aren't all perfectly parallel to each other, but there's a dispersion of their orientations within a given small domain of the muscle. And that dispersion we've previously measured to be equivalent to a standard deviation, an angular standard deviation of about plus or minus 12 degrees. So if you integrate those, if you take this good data on all this stuff, so you don't have to guess anything here, if you take all the measurements on the lattice geometry, on the cross-bridge geometry, the lattice geometry, and the dispersion of the fiber angles and the tissue, integrate it together and make some simple but well-motivated assumptions about how strain modifies those angles. Okay. So in other words, if the strain is more longitudinal than sideways, it'll tend to make the angles more acute, and if it's more sideways than longitudinal, it'll tend to make them more oblique, then you can get a strain-dependent prediction of the fiber and cross-fiber stresses generated at the tissue level that actually independently show good agreement with those experimental measurements that Lin and Yin published. Okay. So this just shows what happens if we... These are measurements of strain made in our lab using biplane radiography of implanted markers implanted through the thickness of the left ventricular wall in dogs. And you can't see them here, but these symbols are actually means plus or minus standard deviations, very accurate. These measurements done by Reza Mezhari. And they're resolved, so this goes from endocardium, epicardium to endocardium, all six components of the strain tensor with resolved with respect to fiber and cross-fiber and radial axes during systole, where the reference state is end-diastole.
I have a simple question. How do you know that the stress is normal to the fiber orientation, the main fiber orientation, which is not induced by the stress along with fiber, like it's transretroautotropic? How do you know that it's really active as opposed to induced by the force along with fiber?
Well, the assumption is that the force along the fiber is being induced by the interaction of the cross bridge of the thick and thin filaments. And that's the origin of where that force comes from.
And that then gets
resolved into components along but also transverse to the cell. And that then gets integrated to the cell scale, and then from there gets integrated for the distribution of fiber orientations within the cell. Then you build in the passive properties which cause some nonlinear coupling as well. And that's where this comes from. Okay. This is the model. These are the comparison of the model for these strain components, systolic strain components, when the model assumed uniaxial active stress. And these are the comparisons when the transverse stress development was incorporated. So you can see there's a very big difference. So I tend to agree with, it's not perfect agreement with the experiments, but a huge difference in, and the error is obviously reduced, and so I tend to agree with Julius's conclusions that he described earlier. So finally, we've talked now about functional integration at the level of the network, and then structural integration at the level of the cell and the tissue and the organ. But you know, the goal here is to do structural and functional integration. So, for example, develop a model of the electromechanics of the heart. And this is the scheme that we are working on and developing, where there's a mechanics model that is represented by a set of partial differential equations that we have to integrate. There's an electrical model that's represented by a set of partial differential equations that we have to integrate and evolve in time. And then there's a cellular model, namely a system of ordinary and differential and algebraic equations that describes the coupled mechanisms as a system, set of systems equations for the ionic calcium handling, filament activation and filament interaction mechanisms that both the electrical model and the mechanical model need to interrogate. So the coupling occurs at the level of the cell, not at the level of the tissue. At least that's the goal. Not all the models that we've done, including the ones I'll show you, actually use this full scheme, but this is the objective, and this is the basic strategy and theory. Now, to do an electromechanics model where we're studying the effect of pacing from different sites on the ventricular wall on the mechanics, which is the question at hand here, there's a few other things that I haven't mentioned that we have to take into account, and the key one is the conducting system, the specialized conducting system. So the whole heart pattern of electrical activation, both during sinus rhythm and to a certain extent during ectopic pacing, say if you have a pacemaker, depend critically on the specialized conduction system. And so we needed a way to incorporate that, and without going into the details, we used experimental measurements in Peter and Bruce Smale's lab made by Ian McRice to make a sort of a continuum model of the Purkinje fiber network anatomy that we mapped onto the endocardium of the canine model, and then we validated the sinus rhythm activation patterns with some data that were available mostly from humans. This particular model did not have the cellular heterogeneity, and so here you see the T wave is inverted because all the cells are the same. This particular application of the coupled electromechanical model then added another wrinkle, which is that this heart is dilated and failing based on some experiments by David Cass and Elliot McVeigh, and asynchronous. So this is a model of a failing left and right ventricles of a dog heart that also has conduction asynchrony due to left bundle branch block. So asynchronous, electrical asynchrony and mechanical dysfunction. And because bundle branch block is a fairly common complication of congestive heart failure in men, cardiac resynchronization theory by using one or more pacemakers on the ventricles to improve the synchrony of electrical activation has actually been seen in the clinic and in experiments to improve the function of the ventricles somewhat. And so this model here shows biventricular pacing now, where there's a pacing site here on the left ventricle and a pacing site there on the right ventricle, and they're being paced simultaneously. And as a result of that altered excitation sequence, we get altered mechanics. And it's hard to see exactly what the differences are, but if you look at the septum, you see the septum moves in a different way, and you can detect that the sequence of electrical excitation is more synchronous. So how does this look? If we just compare the improvement with biventricular pacing seen in the model with that seen experimentally, the agreement was really quite good, considering there are really no adjustable parameters in this model that we fiddled with. We based everything as closely as we could on the conditions that were described in the experiments. And you can see, for example, that the improvement in DPDT, the maximum DPDT, was similar. The improvement in DPDT min wasn't quite so close. And the change in ejection fraction was almost too close for comfort. And that 4.5% may not sound like very much, but when your ejection fraction is 23%, you'll take every percent you can get. The other thing we were able to do, and the reason for this is probably not surprising, is because basically the synchrony of mechanical shortening was improved, so the time course of shortening improved along with the time course with the improvement in electrical synchrony. There's actually quite a lot more to the story, but just one other thing is we could actually get a 7.5% improvement in ejection fraction instead of 4.5 if we actually made introduced a delay between the pacing on the left side and the right side. So it's a 15 millisecond LR sequential pacing delay actually resulted in a somewhat further improvement in mechanical synchrony in this model. This is another electromechanical model that was done recently by Roy Kirchhoff in collaboration with investigators including Peter, Jim Bassingthwaite, Chris Johnson and co. And the purpose of this study was to couple these models to models of the circulation that reproduce the changes that occur not in one beat or two beat, but in 2 hours of heartbeats that were measured in an experimental animal after acute injury to the heart. Basically, I'm showing you this to describe that there are all kinds of tricks that we were able to employ, mostly using pre-computing and interpolation, so that instead of being able to do one or two beats, which is what we've mostly been able to show you in the past, it has actually been possible to predict patterns of electromechanics over periods of hours during which the boundary conditions and external conditions are changing.
What's happening with the blood pressure?
So if you're wondering why the blood pressure has this funny whip here, I sort of objected to this in the model since that's an output of the model, but it's an output of the model that was fitted to experiments, and in those experiments there was an artifact that others may have better explanations, but I think it's just the catheter whipping around the ventricle. Normally when you see that in the ventricle you pull the catheter back a little bit, we didn't do these experiments, so... So if I have time, maybe I'll just switch gears one more time and give just one example of data integration. And here, our model system is a little different. It's the fruit fly Drosophila. And our original motivation for studying Drosophila was because of an interest in cardiac aging. Heart disease is far and away a disease of aging. And the vast majority of heart patients are over 65 years of age. Drosophila, the adult fruit fly, has about a 2-month lifespan, and so it makes it possible to do experiments on aging in that are really much more difficult to do even in a mouse, let alone a larger mammal. So what we wanted to do is perform screens of cardiac function in Drosophila. And so what we had to do in order to do this is develop an automated way of measuring cardiac function in not one or two, but hundreds of flies. And so the method we developed is an automated method that actually automatically now anesthetizes the flies, sticks them onto a microscope slide, wings down, finds the fly, traces out the boundary of the fly, works out where the heart is, okay, draws a little sort of line scan across the heart to make an in mode, like a fly in mode, like this. So this is the, and then saves some, works out the dominant frequency and the variability and saves some statistics. And this takes about a minute per fly. And so now we can do genome-wide screens as a function of an intervention like age or a drug or we're doing new studies on hypoxia resistance, for example. And what you can imagine is that this actually generates a lot of data. For example, this shows the heart rates in the flies that are 10 days old versus flies that are 54 days old. And as a function of temperature, which was the intervention that we chose as a stress. Okay. So this is a fly stress test. It's a fly stress echo in young flies and old flies. Okay. And you see a couple of things. One is that the basal heart rate, it's about 4 to 5 hertz, is significantly lower in the old flies than the young flies. But also the ability of the heart rate of increased heart rate, the chronotropic reserve of the fly, also diminishes with age. And by magnitude and the sort of time course through life, these reduction in basal heart rate and the reduction in chronotropic reserve are actually not that different from what have been described in humans over 7 decades. Okay. Now we can do what's called genomic phenotyping, where take large libraries of mutants, we use so-called P-element mutants, and we screen for those as a function some variable, some other variable, in this case age, okay, for those that have a slower or eliminated age-related decline in cardiac function, or those that have an accelerated age-related decline in cardiac function. And then, so these, for example, the genes that were mutated that gave rise to this eliminated or reduced age-related decline in heart function are putative cardiac aging genes. Okay. So the idea here is you go through 10,000 mutants and you find the 2 or 3 magic bullets and you say, aha, I found the cardiac aging gene. Well, that actually isn't what happens at all, because although we found that there were, in fact, many mutants that have minimal or no age-related decline in cardiac function. The fact is there were very many. So, for example, in an early screen of 700 mutants, 52 of them actually had essentially no age-related decline in cardiac function, which means genome-wide, we would expect to find 1,000 cardiac aging genes. Interestingly, a large fraction of them were mitochondrial, which suggests that metabolic processes may be very intrinsic. But what we have is a whole new data integration and systems biology problem, for which I certainly don't have the answers at this stage. But one strategy that we've started to use is to take that large network of genes that have been identified through this phenotypic screen, and see how they're related to each other, against another set of data. And for example, what this diagram shows is a putative protein-protein interaction network. So each one of the nodes in this diagram is a protein, and each one of the lines is a possible protein-protein interaction that was identified by yeast 2 hybrid screens. That doesn't mean that there has any functional significance at all. It just means that if you take one protein, express it, and then go fish and find out the ones that interact or may interact, then there's a lot of interactions, and this network has properties. And what we can do is see what the properties of the genes that we find are in the network. And I don't have time to go through the whole story, but it seems that it seems to be in common so far, the thing that we've found in common with these aging genes, is that they seem to be more tightly coupled than an average gene. So they're more likely to be hubs of the network, which actually suggests that the aging mechanism could be a very generalized degradation. In some ways, it's a non-specific sort of finding, but nevertheless, it's interesting and opened up a new avenue for us. Before I close, I just wanted to mention that the finite element models that I showed you and the multi-scale models that I described are done with a software package that's supported by the National Biomedical Computation resource called Continuity, and it's freely available for anyone who's interested in that sort of thing to download and use, and it's available on Macintoshes and Linux and Windows, and it runs on clusters, and we're continually improving it. We do a new release about twice a month. So you're very, very welcome to go to our website and download it, and then when you have trouble, to let us know. Lastly, I just want to acknowledge my collaborators. The signaling work was was done by Jeff Sorsaman, recent PhD student of mine, now has a faculty position at UVA. The wedge model was done by Sarah Healy, and Jake Fiala is the PhD student who did the Drosophila work. We have a lot of collaborators at other institutions whose names I won't mention, but thanks very much for your time.